Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point,
I said, "One sec, babe," and dragged my leg behind me to the bar, but couldn't remember the word for blister in Spanish. I managed to hit on something like, "Mister, this old leg is hot, and inside is the queso from that bike of my lover. Help me hold the burn. Thank you, mister."
We talk with Mary Louise Parker about her new memoir, Dear Mr. You. You might think from your mailbox that letter writing is on the wane. But a new memoir by Mary Louise Parker may just revive the art. While she is known for her work as an award-winning actress, including roles on Broadway, in Weeds, Angels in America, and The West Wing, her memoir is comprised entirely of letters to the men in her life, including her father, ex-boyfriends, teachers, and the future man who loves her daughter. It's called Dear Mr. You. Mary Louise Parker, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I wouldn't dream of not having you. Author Mary Carr wrote that your book came seemingly out of the blue. Did it for you?
I guess this particular book did, in a way, and certainly to other people who know me as an actress. And I think, you know, who might have an assumption about what kind of book Mary Louise Parker would write, which thankfully it isn't quite that book, but extremely generous with me. Extremely generous.
What would that book be? What do you think?
Well, I think generally when someone who's already sort of established as one thing in people's minds turns and does something else, people didn't have any previous knowledge of me as a writer unless they read my things in Esquire or a couple of other magazines. And even some of my friends didn't know that I wrote for Esquire. And some of my closest friends, of course, know that I wrote and have always written poetry and things like that. But it's not a surprise to them. But to, you know, the general public, I think they probably thought I would write, you know, about being an actress or something like that.
So did you feel like you had this book in you all along and it was just a matter of finding the opportunity to express it? Or really, was it sort of like, you know,
book, I don't think. I think, I've always wanted to write a book. And certainly as magazines now, that's sort of a dying art form in a way. And there are less and less pages. So there were fewer opportunities for me to write for Esquire. And I was really hungering to write something a bit bigger. And it takes me a very long time to decide sometimes. And I was writing short stories and this, and I tried to write a novel. And then I had written one piece for Esquire that became what is now the invocation in the book. And it was just a sort of open letter to men and what I love about men. And I loved writing it so much that I felt I could have kept writing it forever. It just was so freeing. And I loved being able to put, you know, this poetic experience, mash it right up against something more mundane and, you know, like the guy at the concession stand and the guy who carried me up the stairs or to the ER. And it was just, it felt like a true Valentine. And that was the first one. And then I just experimented from there. And I thought, well, maybe there's a book with that.
Why did you decide to write in letter form?
Well, there's something I love about the direct address because it feels... Obviously, it feels more truthful because it's immediate and you feel like you are definitely speaking to someone and you can kind of invest in that reality a little bit more because the narrator's voice becomes more authoritative in a way. It becomes like, this is the person that I am speaking to and I am addressing that person as opposed to some sort of fictional reality that's been created, you know, with the sort of the fog of fiction in front of it. I feel like it's just... It feels a little less passionate to me.
Well, the immediacy really comes through. I'm reading it myself and thinking about the you. Occasionally, I would stop and think, wait, is she talking to me, you, or you, the person who is
the
subject of this letter?
And
it was really a cool effect, actually.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. Did you find yourself, after you would write, editing or censoring yourself in any way?
Well, I edit wildly. I mean, I had 50 drafts of Cerberus, and at one point it had a character of a large bird in it. So I do edit and in terms of polishing, but in terms of censoring myself, I think that happened naturally because I wanted this to be a positive book, and I wanted it to be, you know, I have a son and it's a book about men, and I wanted it to be about heroic moments and romantic moments and good moments. And I didn't want to indict anyone. And in one of my piece about my best friend when she had her baby, I mentioned a song that comes on the radio that I didn't like, that I didn't want to be playing when the baby was born. So I'm very particular about music, and I didn't want him to come into the world with this. But I X out the song partly for form. I like the way it looks on the page, but also because I don't want to slight anyone. I did that once when I was writing a piece for a magazine, and I took a shot at somebody. And when I saw it in print, I was so filled with shame, and it was a very important lesson for me, because it's, once you've written it, it's indelible now. You know, things go out in 100 different ways. You don't know where they end up, and there's no reason to take a shot at anyone. And if I've ever done that before, it was massively shaming to me to see it afterwards and think, you didn't have to do that. And how, you know, and also as someone who experiences that, I know what it feels like. And there's no reason to, and it certainly doesn't enhance the writing necessarily. There's a way to write without doing that, I think.
Well, you did. I mean, in so many of the stories, there's first names used occasionally, and I'm actually not even sure if they're all their real names or meant to represent. But even in the one you mentioned, Cerberus, you're calling these three guys out on their absolutely shameful behavior without ever saying their name.
Yeah. Well, with that piece, I mean, it could be four men, it could be five. The point was really, I wrote it like a fairy tale. At first, I thought, cool, I can use different fonts. but ultimately, there was something to making, just almost polarizing it so much, the dynamic, and making myself almost the cartoon of the perfect angelic person above reproach, you know, being, you know, mistreated by these monstrous Leviathan creature, you know, and that was fun. And I thought it would add levity to the story, because I didn't want the story to seem like I was trying to elicit sympathy, you know. I laughed almost the most when I was writing that one, because I thought it allowed for levity to put it in a sort of fantasy realm. It allowed for a lot of irony. And as I say in it, I could be the monster in someone else's story, and I was complicit, you know, whatever I provoked or needed or, I don't know, was looking for in those relationships is something I'm still trying to figure out. It's more of a conversation. I didn't figure it out by writing that story, but for whatever reason, I put up with that longer than I should have, and that makes me complicit, you know? And I had to learn how to say stop. And I am grateful for those relationships, for that and for other reasons. They had, you know, there are sweet moments. I say sweet beast at the very beginning of the book. So it did have, there were sweet moments interspersed, but, and there was also much graver mistreatment that isn't even, I say, no one would believe how mean you are. And that's true also. But the point of the story is that I learn from that, and it's I learn from it in a way that I can pass on to my daughter, and that's the big, big gift.
How old is your daughter?
She's 9.
At what point do you think she might read this?
I don't know. She asks me, and I say, well, why? Do you want to read it now? Not that I would have her read all of it now, but she's, I don't know. I want to read it. And she's heard me read from some of it from her letter. And she likes that I claim in that letter that I will come back from the grave and hurt someone if they're mean to her. but I don't know. When she feels ready to read it, she'll read it. I think, you know, again, I didn't write anything mean-spirited, and it's truthful and it's imaginative, and there is sex in it, but I'm not somebody who's freaked out by sex, and, you know, I don't find it shameful, and I'm pretty easy with that part of life. You know, I have a harder time with, why can't I have more Twizzlers? So-and-so has Twizzlers every day at lunch. You know, those things I have a harder time with.
Has anyone that you've written to in the book that's still alive written back?
Yes. Yes. And also people who are not in the book have written me beautiful letters, said, you know, I was inspired by your writing of letters. And it means so much to me. And my best friend, whose baby was born, little Al, she wrote me a beautiful letter. And she says, I never write letters. And it just meant so much to me that she put it down on paper. And the doctor, dear doctor, he wrote me a letter, dear patient. And a guy that was working with me when I was putting the book together and when I was sick in the hospital, writing it, who's my assistant and then became a friend, he wrote, when he stopped working for me, the beautiful letter. He wrote a letter, dear no caller ID, because every time I'd call him, he couldn't tell who was calling him. So I've gotten wonderful letters.
Well, I heard that your literary agent shopped Dear Mr. You around to publishers anonymously.
He did, yeah. It was pretty clever of him.
And well, and you apparently you got a ton of interest. But I'm really curious, this is a memoir. So how did that work?
Nobody knew, even knew that it was an actress. And I think when you read the book, there's not much about acting in there. And the letters that he first sent out, none of them really gave that away. I'm so grateful to him for doing that, because I never would have had the guts to come up with an idea like that. In that moment when he called me and said I was right and people seemed to love it, was so validating for me that I couldn't even talk myself out of feeling good. You know, I just took it. And I really took it in. I was so happy. And I felt like if nothing else happens, I know that these people really responded to my writing and they knew nothing about me or had no preconceptions, no projections about me as an actress or what I look like or what they thought or what, you know, what they assumed about me. It made me so happy.
Why did he come up with that idea?
I think he just didn't want anything to interfere with it, because he's always said, and he's so massively important to me, Eric Simonoff, and has, there would just not, would be a book without him, there would not be. And he really believed in it and in me from day one as a writer, period, and it as literature, period, and having nothing to do with my acting. And he wanted to sort of prove that right off the bat and say, I'm not going to tell you who this is, and see if you respond to the writing. And it's one of the nicest things that's ever happened in my life, honestly. You know, I'm really, really hard on myself. And I felt, like I said, like I couldn't talk myself out of feeling good about that.
Why did you write letters just to the men in your life?
Well, because I'd started with that one in Esquire. And it was so, I'm a romantic and I loved writing about men and romance and the idea of like all these encounters and sex and heroism. And I just love that. And when I went to write another one, I thought of, I'd already written one to my father, which wasn't a letter form, but I turned it into letter form for the book. And then I thought of my accountant, this man who's been so amazing to me and met me, was this 22-year-old crazy blonde girl who wandered into his office and had no money. And he's treated me like a daughter and with such respect and such love and care. And we have the greatest relationship. And I just thought, I'm going to try to write about that moment, that day that he met me, that I came in and he had to tell me I was broke. And then I fell asleep on his couch for 3 hours. And, you know, I ended up knowing him all these 30 years later, and he's been a massive part of my life. And for my father, too. My father really was fond of him.
This is Dear Abraham.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the sections that I really enjoyed was Dear Former Boyfriend.
Mm.
And I was wondering if you would read a bit for us.
Sure.
From that one, I was falling out of my chair with laughter, because the scenario that you're going to read is really not, it's really kind of awful, actually, what's happening. But I was reading it as if I was your friend, and this is going to sound so weird, but as if I was your friend and you were telling me the story at a great distance from when it
right.
had happened. Well, and so we were both able to laugh about it.
Massive distance. And this guy was awesome. He was great. But I just remembered this one incident when things started to go not so well. And they kind of went downhill because of my inability to communicate like a normal person. I was extremely frustrating, I think. But okay, so this is one day we'd been fighting and we decided to go out because he was hungry. This is Dear Former Boyfriend. We made it outside, which was an adjustment, and you yelled, let's go to that place in Malibu. And I shouted back, sounds great, but I think I just burned my leg on your exhaust pipe. You said, oh, I'm sure they'll have Neosporin at the bar. We drove up the coast and pulled in, jumping off your bike and heading for the entrance, but the door was locked and the place was closed. You walked back to the bike and put your head in your hands, taking a deep breath and trying to fathom the unfairness of life. Kind of how I imagine Moses looked when Pharaoh's magicians kept coldly one-upping him every time he thought he'd nailed it by, like, turning an umbrella into a boa constrictor, or how disappointed Mel Gibson looked on that poster for Braveheart. I put my hand on your back and said, sorry, babe, I know you're starving. You said, voice cracking from the memory, that you'd only had half a Pop-Tart and an Amstel Light 23 hours ago, and now you felt like an outlaw. I said, wow. I said, don't cry. You said, I'm not crying, damn it. You gunned out of the parking lot, grunting something that sounded like strip mall. We rode another 20 minutes before pulling up to another restaurant as it was closing, and when you realized the gruesome reality that they wouldn't stay open, you threw your helmet into the gravel and raised a fist to the gods. I'm starving, you bellowed. I could eat my bike. I need chips like I need oxygen, my kingdom for a chimichanga. I started to space out to avoid agitating you further, and we got back on your bike and you roared, on to that dive downtown. I raced to put my helmet back on, but in my rush, it ended up backward on my face like Ichabod Crane, and I was suddenly blind and could not breathe except for one eye hole that had landed near an open nasal passage. I didn't realign it for fear of being thrown from your Harley, and I tried squeezing you and yelling over the wail of your bike that I needed air, but you thought I was being comforting and called out not to worry, the next place would have your combo plate or you would decapitate someone. As you slowed, pulling into the parking lot, I reached up to shift the helmet so I would not lose consciousness and gave a thumbs up in victory when you cried out that God was on your side, they were open. I let out a muffled, wah-wah! From inside the helmet as you lurched forward into a parking spot, jerking me so violently that I stabbed myself in the shoulder with my thumb. But I was so happy to take off my helmet and see dimension in front of me and shapes that I did a kind of crippled sideways skip toward the restaurant. As we entered, the host looked at me with concern and said, Buenas noches, is Senorita in fine shape tonight? He was staring at my hair, which had gone stiff from the wind and nearly horizontal from my body. I said, "See," as you pulled me toward a table, and the waiter appeared and we ordered. I began to wonder what was sticking to my calf, so I held a candle from the table to my leg, and I saw that my leg was stuck to my leg. The exhaust burn had grown to the size of a Kinder egg. I said, "One sec, babe," and dragged my leg behind me to the bar, but couldn't remember the word for blister in Spanish. I managed to hit on something like, Mister, this old leg is hot, and inside is the queso from that bike of my lover. Help me hold the burn. Thank you, mister, which confused him. But then I put my leg on a stool and pointed, and the sight registered to the bartender, who was sympathetic. Minutes later, I limped back with a tube of Neosporin in one hand while holding an ice pack to my leg with the other. You were now lucid, and realized I was hungry too, but you'd eaten all the chips in the basket. I was getting lightheaded from my flesh wound and from breaking the sound barrier on Ventura Highway when our food arrived. You looked at my plate and said, Beauty, you ordered so well. You didn't glimpse at your own dinner as you dipped into my guacamole. I eyed your plate. You had, in front of you, a similar combo, including guacamole. I stopped moving entirely and watched you dip a chip in my guacamole and say, What is that? But just altogether f***ing yum. You weren't looking at me as you continued to eat my food, and I couldn't move from rage. There was such a fog around me that I felt like I had entered a White Snake video. I had a rush of leaving the physical plane, and I watched from the ceiling as I took my fork and stabbed you in the hand that was reaching, again, toward the last of my guacamole. The fork made contact and stayed lodged in the fleshy part at the top of your hand, the part they tell you to squeeze if you have a migraine. And then I removed it, and I re-entered my body. I didn't feel recognizable human emotions, but knew my name, and could maybe quote some of the liner notes from Bat Out of Hell. No one moved. You stared at your hand and said softly, Whoa, you drew blood.
Thank you. Do you relive it when you read this? I mean, this is your life.
A little bit, yeah.
How did you know you wanted to be an actress?
I feel like it was something that I knew before I even knew what you called it, because I was so shy and very, very awkward and very quiet. And I stuttered, actually. And they put me in a dance recital. And I think everyone was, I remember people being sort of hovering around me and there being some sense of somehow understanding that people were concerned that maybe I would be nervous. And I just remember getting up on the stage with absolutely no fear and being very, very happy there. And subsequently always feeling that no matter what the case was, as long as it was some kind of performance. You see that in kids. I see it now when I go to my kid's school and I've seen one kid in a few productions. I know that one or that one or that one. They just have that thing. It's just, you can just tell some kids have it. But acting in particular, you know, I wanted to be a theater actress. So I went to theater school and I was, that's what I was hoping for, was to do regional theater, which I did do, and to do new plays, which I've been lucky enough to do as well.
Well, actually, let me ask you a question about your dad.
Mm.
I think that you wrote in the book that he also wrote poetry.
He wrote a little. He did. I think he might have been a writer had it not been, you know, that time in the world where you go into the war at the age of 19. He loved poetry, though. He understood it viscerally. And he was somebody who, he did not have some Ivy League education. He did not grow up. He grew up with coal miners and backwoods people in Kentucky, and there's not a snotty bone in his body. And he could converse with anyone. He was interested in everyone and everything, and the most generous spirit, the most inclusive person I've ever met. His capacity for astonishment and for happiness and for rage and for emotion and loyalty, especially, I've never really seen or experienced again in my life in any way.
The letter at the end of your book is so moving. It's such a tribute to your relationship with your dad. And I was wondering if you would read a little bit of it.
So in writing to my father, I thought I had written a letter about him at the beginning. And our relationship was so massive and so deep and layered. And there was so much more to say about him. And I really thought if I was going to write a book about men that I had to get across how heroic he was and how deep and profound. And in order to do that, I had to show other sides of him that I wasn't sure I would feel comfortable revealing. But I think he would have wanted it like that, you know, to show the extremes of him. And also, there's no such thing as, you don't become a hero in a vacuum, right? You know, the fact is that he evolved to this place in his life where he was so grateful and so open and so big-hearted, but he had to go through something to get there, right? And that made it much more profound to me. So I did show a bit of that. And the letter is to the oyster picker, who is the person who I got him oysters for his last meal. Because I asked him if he wanted anything when I was leaving the apartment one day. And it made me consider, where do oysters come from? I thought, you don't just order them and they don't just show up on your plate, you know? Writing to that oyster picker was also a way of acknowledging the people that do things for us. We have no idea the sacrifices they make and what they go through. And they give us like these little, not little, they give us these profound gifts, you know? So that was his last meal. And this is the letter to the oyster picker that picked those oysters. Dear oyster picker, this is a little bit in the middle of the letter. Raw oysters are not cheap. But if you trace that pearly slip back to the moment it was plucked, you'll find an underpaid someone who did the plucking. Please, though, I'm not suggesting that you work a lowly job. I just mean that you should make at least as much as a gynecologist who spends less time than you do all hunched over and plunging into the salty depths with rubber gloves on. You probably go through 2 pairs of those gloves a week, not only to shield you from the frigid surf, but to guard against the gashes that end up on your wrists and forearms from those tongs that pry your crop from its seabed. Your back must ache from being bent over for hours while slogging through mud that can reach your knees. That tub of mollusks that will make memorable someone's first date can weigh up to 70 pounds. I suspect that costs your body a lot. I wonder if you grow tired of always wearing the sea, dragging the sound of waves to your pillow every night. You must fall there light as an astronaut once your ankles are unshackled of wet earth and seaweed. I've tried to imagine your face when I would tell you our story, the one about how we never met and how I have many pieces from you collected and sorted. I picture myself walking to you at the shoreline and waiting until you see me. I play that tape over and over with no sound, our voices drowned out by the unrelenting applause of the ocean. I tell you everything too emotional and abstract to say to someone you don't know, but still you understand it. You understand all of it.
Thank you. Mary Louise, what's the best advice about writing that you've ever received?
The last line of my book was really more of an instruction. My dad, when he was dying, he just said to me, he was asking me what I was writing, you know, and we were just talking about things. And I said, oh, just this and that. I don't know. And he said, well, just write. Keep writing. Just promise me you'll write.
Well, thank you. Thank you for writing.
Thank you.
That was actress Mary Louise Parker. Her memoir, Dear Mr. You, is available now. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point, like Scott McGlashan and Lisa Gwinther, who are helping bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you can too at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.